Hello and welcome to Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and its region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review the podcast wherever you listen to it. Now, this is the bit where I flag up Turkey Book Talk's new membership system. If you want extra benefits and content while also supporting the podcast going forward, then do consider becoming a member. If you sign up as a paying member, you'll get access to full transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk in PDF form as soon as the episode is published. You'll also receive transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive in English, which amounts to 60 conversations so far. Most of these transcripts were previously published at the Hurriyet Daily News, but from now on, a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access them. That archive also includes many interviews not previously published on the podcast. As a member, you will also get access to a special 30% discount on Turkey and Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus. They have a fantastic archive of titles and have made over 200 books from their Turkey Ottoman history series available at cut price, exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members through a special discount code. A number of IB Taurus authors have been hosted on the podcast in the past, so becoming a member is obviously a great way to get more acquainted with their work. So do consider signing up. If you do become a member, you'll be helping us to develop the podcast. And if more members sign up, we may end up being able to start publishing a new episode every week, up from the current one episode every 2 weeks. To become a Turkey Book Talk member, you just have to pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account. At present, we post new episodes bi-weekly, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. If we end up becoming able to publish a new episode every week, then that will go up to $12 monthly maximum, which is not too bad a deal. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then everything helps and you'll certainly be more than welcome. But as long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members are only charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. The aim of the membership system is to turn Turkey Book Talk into a completely sustainable, reliable, and wide-ranging source, providing a bigger platform for even more authors, journalists and researchers to get the word out about their work. But to do that, we need your support, so do consider taking advantage of this new membership system. You can find details of how to sign up via armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com or through any of the other Turkey Book Talk pages. But now let's get on with our latest episode. In it, we welcome Max Hoffman, who's Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. Last month, they published a major study called "Is Turkey Experiencing a New Nationalism? An Examination of Public Attitudes on Turkish Self-Perception." The study was based on focus groups and national polling conducted in partnership with the Metropol Research Company. The headline data that comes through is unsurprising. Turkey remains a deeply nationalist, conservative country, and the national mood is prickly, defensive, and conspiratorial. But the report also contains some fascinating and perhaps surprising details about attitudes to President Erdogan, levels of religiosity in young people, and the political opinions of Turkish women. We dig into some of those details later on, but I started by asking Max Hoffman to give us some of the broad headline info that the survey highlights.
The poll was based on an initial round of focus groups we did late in 2017, and the whole project was sparked by a desire to understand the nationalist currents that appeared to be gaining strength in Turkey, particularly since the coup attempt, but also predating the coup attempt. And there had been a lot written, both in Turkey and the West, you know, about this nationalist wave or this populist wave, but nobody had much granular detail or insight into what sort of the components of it were, or how unified it was, or you know, what it meant. So that was where the poll project came from. We ran these focus groups, and those focus groups helped us craft questions for a nationwide poll that we fielded in the middle of November 2017. And the poll confirmed a lot of understandings for those of us following Turkey closely. The country's in a defensive crouch after 5-6 years of pretty profound security threats, as well as Erdogan's rhetoric that sort of elevates that sense of threat and danger to the country and to the Turkish people. The thing that came through clearly in the focus groups, and of course, on the front pages of the newspapers every day, is the extent to which Turkish political thinking and Turkish politics is defined by this very conspiratorial mindset that there are threats or international plots lurking behind every door. And the other thing it confirmed that's not new but is profound is the deep hostility towards the West. After these years of security threats, Turkey feels it's been betrayed by its traditional Western security partners, and that's reflected in very negative attitudes towards them. Europe polls at 21%. NATO at 24%. Germany and the American people are both at 18%. And then the U.S., you know, the United States government is down at 10%. And those aren't maybe surprising, but the depths of that hostility came through very clearly. And so this is in the context of this very nationalist mood. And the response is, well, our traditional partners have betrayed us, and so we should go it alone. And so overwhelmingly, those Turks surveyed favored a go-it-alone approach in foreign policy over international cooperation. 55% wanted the country to go its own way, to 37% wanted to cooperate more with the rest of the world. They favored confrontation with the U.S., and that extends to a large extent, you know, across party lines. And in terms of the politics, Erdogan remains dominant but deeply polarizing, as we know. But the opposition is completely splintered. So, you know, in our projections for an early election were one to be held, the AKP's majority would be strengthened, although it depends a great deal on whether HDP and E are all sort of close to the 10% threshold. So obviously the exact totals would matter a great deal. But there didn't seem to be a realistic pathway for an opposition challenge. That said, you know, there were some rumblings among younger AKP voters. A lot of young AKP voters, both in the poll and the focus groups, seem to regard Erdogan as sort of the least bad option or the best of the bad options. He's more popular than any other political figure active in Turkey still, even among young voters. But there's a lot of discontent, and that is not maybe surprising given 22% youth unemployment and relatively slow income growth. Well, actually flat income growth since really 2007, 2008 in terms of per capita figures. So that was interesting. The other, you know, there were some interesting analytical points. I mean, the AKP is often presented both in Turkey and the West as effectively an Islamist party, and that doesn't really come through in the polling. Only about 35% of the AKP, 30 to 35% support what could be considered Islamist political goals and are skeptical of secularism. And that small sort of 25-35% of the AKP are also supportive of things. 20% would support the restoration of the caliphate. 26% would support Sharia law. But again, this is a small part of the AKP, and most of the AKP is just a nationalist, maybe socially conservative party, more open to religion, but also believing in the secular foundations of the republic. So the way we were trying to understand this was, we talk about compassionate Islamists as this minority, sort of 25-30% of the party. And then there's this growing nativist strain on the right wing, on the nationalist side of the party, that we referred to as Turkey firsters. And it's a difficult balancing act for Erdogan because they disagree on a number of things. They disagree, for example, on the Syrian refugee issue, most importantly. The compassionate Islamists are willing to care for these refugees, believe it's important to care for the Ummah. The Turkey firsters don't want them in Turkey, want them gone. But so Erdogan is really focused on the things that unite them. And the one thing that unites them more than anything is this hostility towards the West and sort of standing up to the West, especially the U.S. So Erdogan has emphasized that, and also presenting Turkey as a strong power capable of projecting itself into regional and global affairs. That appeals to some extent to both the compassionate Islamists and the Turkey firsters. So I'll maybe leave it there. There's a lot more to unpack, but those are some of the big findings. And the most important, you know, thing that we should really come back to is the Syrian refugee issue, because it by far is the most important and emotional issue and critical issue for Turkish voters. And it's the biggest political liability for Erdogan and the AKP. So it definitely deserves more study.
And I want to go into some of those details a bit later. But first of all, really, the poll goes into detail on a lot of political and identity questions. And you also mention in it this educational divide. And I think this is important because, you know, accompanying the narrative around the rise of populism and nationalism elsewhere, there's been a lot of focus really on how education levels are really now one of the key, most defining issues in politics in a lot of countries. Could you just give us an idea of how that maps onto the Turkish context? Is there something similar going on?
There certainly is. That trend is playing out in Turkey for sure. We have data breaking down these results on dozens of questions by education, age, ethnicity, income, religious affiliation. And many of those things don't actually track with political affiliation or sort of measures of nationalist sentiment that we polled. But one that certainly does is this education question. Basically, if you're better educated in Turkey, or more highly educated, I should say, so high school or above, you're were far more likely to be critical of President Erdogan. These people are still nationalists in their views, but they are generally less hostile towards the outside world. They're generally less hostile about international cooperation or hostile towards the West. And the lower educated people in Turkey are absolutely Erdogan's base. He actually, when you break down his approval rating by education, he has a strong approval among people without a high school degree or less. And actually now a plurality of high school educated voters in Turkey disapprove of Erdogan's job performance, and an outright majority disapprove when you get to college educated or above. That of course tracks these educational attainment levels track with other things tied to party identity and political outlook in Turkey. For example, urban voters, people living in urban areas tend to be better educated. Those people tend to be, perhaps more cosmopolitan in their worldview. But it's certainly an interesting breakdown. It's also, I'd say, reflected if you go and look back at the April constitutional referendum and the electoral map that emerged from that race, where you saw these big cities turn against Erdogan. And looking at that map, there were some new elements to it. It didn't look like the traditional Turkish election map of the last decade or 15 years. There were reflections of it, but it looked really like a map of cosmopolitan Turkey versus rural Turkey. So we saw some of that come through in our polling data as well.
And what about the age divide? You mentioned it a bit before there. The report does reference an age divide on various issues, including, of course, on Erdogan himself. I suppose the lightning rod of Turkish politics. Could you just talk a bit about the age divide and how it's reflected in opinions?
The age divide is there, but is small in the polling data. Where it came through really clearly in our focus groups, we had a younger AKP group, an older AKP group, and MHP and CHP groups, and it was more a matter of tone. Again, they still supported Erdogan for lack of a what they viewed as a realistic alternative, but they were more critical. I actually came into this project with the assumption that was subsequently proven wrong. I thought that young AKP voters would be more Erdoganist. They would be more personally tied to Erdogan rather than the AKP as a party or, conservatism or religious conservatism as an outlook. Because I figured these people will have come of age, come of maturity entirely under Erdogan, and so will have, internalized his rhetoric and his worldview. Actually, the opposite seemed to be true. They were slightly less in the poll and much, much more critical in the focus groups, but slightly less supportive in the poll of Erdogan. They were slightly less nationalistic on most measures. And actually, really importantly, young voters or young respondents were significantly less likely to report Islam as being a central part of their personal identity or their understanding of what it means to be Turkish. And that surprised me. I mean, of course, Erdogan's famous desire to raise a pious generation, the shift to Imam Hatip schools or the vast expansion of Imam Hatip schools. I thought that perhaps the younger generation would come through in the poll as more religiously devout and more supportive of Erdogan personally. And the opposite was true on both questions.
There's another quite counterintuitive thing that the report finds, and that's that women tended to have more stridently nationalistic views in this survey. And that might be surprising to many. I wonder if you could just speculate a bit on what's behind that.
Yeah, it was really interesting and surprising, although, I've spoken with a few colleagues who follow nationalism and populism closely, and they said that wasn't surprising to them, that finding has been replicated in other contexts, that there's this perception that women are somehow, going to be kind of softer in their outlook, and that fundamentally it might just be our own sort of sexist outlooks at play there, because that doesn't tend to come through. It was interesting. Women were generally about 7% more, basically more nationalistic on a range of questions. So if we asked, global economic and political elites have too much power over Turkey and should be resisted, do you agree strongly? Do you just agree? Do you somewhat disagree? Do you strongly disagree? Women were more likely to strongly agree with that. Or what else? A strong leader like Erdogan is necessary to protect Turkey's interests, and he should be free to do what is necessary to keep the country safe and prosperous. Women were stronger in their support for that idea. They were stronger also in their personal support for Erdogan and in their support for the AKP. So, and there are a number of other questions I won't get into, but consistently sort of 5-9% stronger support among women for these nationalist positions or these, strong leader questions. And this is speculation, but one of the things that came through in the focus groups that was fascinating is the moderator asks people to describe a bit about their lives at the start of the group. And many of these women in the AKP groups and to some extent the MHP group would say, well, I'm a housewife, or I spend most of my time at home. And it's okay, what do you like to do in your free time? It's like, well, I'm always always watching television. And so we were speculating about the kind of spatial arrangement of these women's lives and the fact that effectively the TV was always on. And if you watch any Turkish television, you know the messages that are being hammered home, and also that Erdogan is just ubiquitous. He's always on the television. So we thought that might play a role in terms of just kind of exposure to this government messaging. The other thing that might explain it is, you know, AKP women are a strong constituency for Erdogan. And what they reported consistently was the headscarf issue still. Even years after its effective resolution, Erdogan's kind of leadership on overturning the headscarf ban, the fact, of course, that his wife wears the headscarf, because this was an issue of access to education and really sort of access to public life for conservative women, there's a deep well of support for Erdogan and gratitude to Erdogan for pushing that issue so strongly. And so that's also, you know, perhaps another explanation for their more nationalistic attitudes and their stronger support for Erdogan and the AKP.
The question of refugees emerges from this report as being really important, and again chimes with a kind of consensus view really that's rising, and that is that refugees are becoming more of a political hot potato in Turkey. You know, there are over 3 million Syrian refugees in Turkey at the moment, and they've been here for many years now, and it does seem to be becoming increasingly a political issue now. Patience does seem to be kind of running out among many people. Could you just talk a bit about how respondents talked about refugees? Because there was quite a bit of hostile rhetoric, and it does seem that it was held pretty much across the political spectrum, really.
It really was. And this issue, people are generally not, respondents were not very happy about the direction of the country overall. They're actually not very happy about the direction of the economy for the most part, although the AKP is happier. So this is in a context of sort of general pessimism, but the Syrian refugee issue comes through very, very strongly, both in the poll and more in the focus groups, the sorts of things you'd hear come through at a really emotional level. So, you know, 78% say that Turkey spends too much time and money on refugees and should focus more on its own citizen. 49% of all respondents strongly agree with that statement. Even in the AKP, 73% feel that way, 45% strongly. So this is really across party lines. It's just 20% or so, the people that we referred to again as compassionate Islamists, who are okay with caring for the refugees and believe immigrants and refugees have an important place in Turkish society. But there's no support beyond that small religious conservative constituency for the refugee policy. And there's a huge well of anger there. And it's a key vulnerability for the government. I think it's driving a lot of Erdogan's recent sort of tack to the right on issues associated with the refugee question. I think it's even driving a lot of the policy towards northern Syria and towards Afrin. You know, in the last 6 months, Erdogan and the AKP leaders have consistently stressed that these operations, whether it's Euphrates Shield or Olive Branch, these are so that the refugees can return home, that we're going to resettle, you know, 300,000 here and 100,000 there. I think it's because they're looking at similar polling numbers to the ones we saw in our poll, and they realize this is a real political vulnerability. Their hands are somewhat tied, of course, because they can't cut off support to the refugees in Turkey. It's clear that millions of these Syrians will remain in Turkey and become part of the fabric of the society. And the societal impacts of sort of taking a really harsh line towards them are potentially disastrous in terms of public health and safety and things like that. So they're in a really difficult situation. And, you know, I think we've all been really awestruck by the generosity of Turkey and the just remarkable way the society has integrated, absorbed so many refugees and cared for them, and how few violent incidents or clashes there have been. But it seems that something is really changing in the last year and a half, and the anger is palpable. In the focus groups, we would consistently hear things like, you know, I never hear Turkish spoken in Fatih anymore. It's all Arabic. All the signs in the supermarket are in Arabic. I feel like a stranger in my own country. You know, these people, they get health, they can go to school, but my grandmother doesn't get her pension check on time. You know, those sorts of things that came across in really visceral, really emotional terms. And it's at one level, it's disconcerting. At another level, you would probably hear the same things in Germany, you know, a year and a half, 2 years ago, or even in, you know, Western Pennsylvania or Texas or somewhere on the immigration question. So Turkey is not immune to these wider kind of right-wing responses to immigration and refugees that have risen up over the last 2 or 3 years. And it's just, it's a worrying sign. You know, these findings were also, these are similar to things that Nigar Göksel and other scholars have found in their own reporting. So it bears watching very closely moving forward because of the potential social impacts in Turkey.
Yeah, it seems to me actually that's sadly where a lot of the E-Party's potential lies. You know, the E-Party, this party of Meral Akşener, of course, and there was a lot of fanfare when the party was launched, but it's not really getting off the ground too much. They're not really getting much media attention, which is unsurprising really. But it does seem that the refugee issue could end up being quite fertile soil for the E-Party, you know, tapping into this mounting discontent over refugees.
Yeah, that's exactly what I anticipated would be the EE party's approach. And actually, I've been somewhat surprised, pleasantly surprised, frankly, the extent to which opposition figures, including Akşener, haven't really taken a hard right tack and attacked the AKP and Erdogan on the refugee issue. Pleasantly surprised because, again, of course, you don't want to see a sort of nativist, right-wing, hostile campaign run. They haven't really done so, and it's somewhat surprising because it's a real political vulnerability for the AKP, as you say. It's not just this sort of generalized discontent, but it also gets right at the heart of the real balancing act that Erdogan has to play with his broad constituency. Again, between these real religious conservatives for whom they view the Syrian refugees as part of the Ummah, as fellow Muslims, and they are actually very proud of Turkey's care for them. They think of Turkey as a benevolent humanitarian power and a sort of a leader for the Muslim world. And then on the other hand, these Turkey firsters, or this nativist strain in the party and on the kind of nationalist right, who want Turkey to go its own way, who think that, you know, they should be looking after Turks first and who cares about the Syrians and send them home and that sort of thing. So it really gets right at the heart of the divide in Erdogan's constituency. I think those two constituencies also are kind of, on the one hand, the compassionate Islamists are perhaps being targeted by Saadet and the Turkey firsters are being targeted by E. But Erdogan has preempted a lot of the nativist challenge. Again, in his shift, he's dramatically, over the last year and a half, he's dramatically escalated his rhetoric, you know, the hostility towards the West, which plays well with both constituencies. And he's started talking about returning the refugees. And of course, he's taken this very, very hard line on the Kurdish question, both at home and in the region. And I think that those three themes are what he's using to try and insulate himself against any right-wing nationalist challenge. So he's taken a lot of the air out of what might have been Meral Akşener's approach. And the result is that our poll finds E polling at 7% and, you know, having the effect of drawing a few percent from the CHP, a few from substantial support from the MHP, but it's unclear. You know, other polls have shown EE's support much higher, so I think it's very fluid and very uncertain. I mean, people still don't have a great sense of what the party stands for or what Akşener's platform is. So it's possible that she'll come out and actually take this really hardline nativist tack as it gets closer to the election, and we'll see how voters respond to that. I do think that there is some kind of vulnerability there because people are not happy about the economy, and conservative nationalist Turks who might otherwise support Erdogan are very angry about the refugee issue. So there's probably there are votes to be won there. And the last thing I just say on EE party support, again, it's very uncertain, but there was more openness among Kurdish respondents than we anticipated. You know, her negative ratings were not as high as we thought they would be, or, you know, the kind of conventional wisdom that no Kurds will vote for Akşener ever because of her history as a nationalist and her history when she was interior minister. I still don't think that there's going to be substantial Kurdish support for her, don't get me wrong. But there was a little bit of openness there, you know, kind of 15% or so who might consider tactical votes for really any party, including E, if it meant getting rid of Erdogan. So I think that it's still too early to tell, but there's no evidence of a big, massive wellspring of support for E. But there's certainly discontent on the right wing of the AKP.
One of the big questions addressed in the report is this question of secularism, and we mentioned it a bit before. You came up with some quite surprising findings. Even the majority of AKP voters are in favour of maintaining secularism in some form. So 61% of AKP voters agree that there should be no official state religion, and only 26% of them support a Sharia state. And that might also be something that's surprising to some listeners. Could you just open it up a little bit?
Yeah, it is interesting. It's difficult to parse it out. This is one where, you know, we're limited in the questions we could ask, and you wish you could break it down further. What I interpret those results as meaning, so the question was, do you agree or disagree with the following statement? Turkey should be a secular state that respects the rights of people from all religious backgrounds to practice their faiths with no official state religion. So it was a pretty explicit description of secularism. And again, strong support across political parties. There were 34% of AKP voters who disagreed. And actually 27% of MHP voters who disagreed, but basically, you know, strong consensus that Turkey is a secular state. Now, I think two things. Many of those AKP voters, and likely many MHP voters, may support Turkey as a secular state with no official religion, but still effective, like basically appreciate Erdogan's use of religious rhetoric. They may still value religion in the public sphere, you know, sort of visible signs of religion. They're just not, they don't necessarily believe the state needs to kind of oversee or push this line. And these questions are somewhat ambiguous, you know, unfortunately. You're trying to capture a pretty complicated idea. So some people may be fixated on a state that respects the rights of people from all religious backgrounds to practice their faiths. That's part of the question. And I imagine religious voters perhaps focus on that part, whereas secularists may focus on the no official state religion or the, you know, a secular state that respects the rights of people. So there's certainly ambiguity there. What I'd say is that the further questions on like support for Sharia law, which was just at 26% in the AKP, or support for the restoration of the caliphate, just 20% within the AKP and even less elsewhere. Those are pretty specific. So there's no indication that the AKP is really bent on making Turkey a religious state a la Iran, where the clerics run the show. There's no support for that. That's unrecognizable to Turks in their conception of what Turkey is or what it means to be a Turk. But the strong support for secularism may not necessarily mean that these voters don't appreciate Erdogan's use of religious symbolism or rhetoric in his political campaigns or, you know, things like that. So there's some ambiguity there, but it certainly gives lie to this extremely simplistic shorthand that even I, you know, I'll admit I've used it myself from time to time, just referring to the AKP as sort of as an Islamist party or a moderate Islamist party. That's not really what it is. It's a broad alliance of nationalists and social conservatives with this growing nativist strain. And I think understanding the AKP constituency a bit better helps make sense of Erdogan and the government's actions as well.
And linked to this, really, Atatürk remains by far the most influential touchstone for Turks of all political stripes. Basically, everyone apart from Kurdish nationalists idolizes him, including most AKP voters, actually. But what I always find when the question of Atatürk comes up, really, is that there's always this variety in people's interpretation about what Atatürk actually represents, which is probably actually why he remains so potent. I mean, so while many people associate Atatürk immediately with secularism, particularly abroad, but also many in Turkey, many other people also just emphasize his kind of nationalism, you know, his warrior-like anti-imperialist credentials, you know, defending national sovereignty. So, you know, whenever Erdogan mentions him these days, he just calls him Gazi Mustafa Kemal, representing this kind of traditional warrior aspect. So you can interpret Atatürk really in any way. And that's something that really comes through in this report. Atatürk remains this potent touchstone across the political spectrum.
That's exactly right. And it's another question like the secularism question where different people are probably projecting different things onto Atatürk. As you said, across all political parties, strong support for him as a figure in terms of favorability, basic favorability towards him. You know, he's still a unifying figure in Turkey. But then if you ask about, you know, do you agree or disagree with the following statement that the political reforms Atatürk first brought to Turkey are under assault? Well, then you lose that consensus immediately, right? CHP voters and MHP voters and HDP voters, the opposition, they strongly agree. Yeah, Erdogan is assaulting Atatürk's reforms. And so for many of them, particularly the CHP, it's secularism. And that comes through in the poll. AKP voters don't feel that way. They, in fact, feel that, you know, that Erdogan is fulfilling Atatürk's ideal of a strong and independent nation, which was another question we asked. AKP voters strongly feel that way. So for them, it's a strong, independent leader. This is Atatürk as the winner of the independence war. This is the Atatürk who stood up to the West and to attempts to divide Turkey. And so for AKP voters, they strongly feel that Erdogan's stance against the West and independent streak on the international stage are in keeping with Atatürk's legacy. And Erdogan has made, you know, a number of people have written about this. Erdogan has made a series of sort of steps and shifts over the last couple of years to try and claim this mantle of Atatürk. I mean, just in constantly talking about the West's efforts to break up Turkey or to keep Turkey down and how Turkey has to forge its own path. And also in his use of the coup coup attempt and the aftermath as this national rallying cry. It seems he's trying to place himself as the bookend to Ataturk and July 15th as sort of the founding myth of the new Turkey, the way the independence war was for Ataturk. This claim to both popular legitimacy and military victory, effectively. It's a potent symbolic thing. In the focus groups, these complexities are also sort of illuminated to some extent. Most people in CHP or MHP groups would say, yes, we love Ataturk. And you'd say, well, why? And they'd say, well, because he brought secularism to Turkey and he won the independence war. You know, typical stuff from a secular curriculum dating back almost a century now. And then for the AKP, it was the strong, you know, independent streak. It was, he stood up to the West. He beat the West militarily. And then some would say, we had one woman say, I'll always respect Ataturk and love Ataturk because, you know, I don't speak Arabic and he translated the Quran into Turkish for me. So this total, you know, for many people, you know, anyone who's read kind of the traditional understanding, academic understanding of what Ataturk's reforms meant, this is turning them on their head. But this is it's one of the messages that's clearly being circulating in AKP circles. And it's part of this reappropriation of Ataturk's legacy, again, to then present Erdogan as the bookend to Ataturk and sort of fulfilling his legacy.
Thinking generally, I've been thinking particularly since the Afrin operation started, really, looking at the state of the media in Turkey, it's almost now really difficult to even talk about measuring popular opinion, because I think we've really reached the stage now where, considering the state of, you know, complete media and information dominance, we're really not measuring public opinion anymore in polls. Instead, we're just really measuring the effectiveness of a kind of propaganda onslaught, really. And on that subject, really, it's important to remember, I think, that as many polls confirm, the vast majority of people in Turkey still get their news from the TV.
Yeah, it's what I'd say as a first response is, encouragingly, we're still able to poll in Turkey and still have a feeling that you're getting at least accurate responses. So we didn't have any questions, even questions about the coup response and, you know, motivation behind some of the crackdown on, you know, on expression and things like that. There were no questions where we got high rates of, you know, non-response rates. So people are willing to speak their mind to, you know, to questioners in the street with a clipboard, noting their information, etc. So that is, I guess, encouraging at one level. The broader question, though, absolutely. I mean, the control of information is almost absolute at this point. And so in terms of the agenda and the sort of assumptions that underpin Turkish politics, those are completely set by the government and the government-associated media. And that's actually one of the things we're looking into studying next, is sort of where and how people get their news and how it shapes their perceptions. But basically, the AKP and the conservative media have had huge success in crafting what is almost a consensus view on some issues. So there's consensus hostility towards the West and towards the United States across political parties. Even people who hate Erdogan hate the U.S. even more. So, and that is the result of regional trends and the result of U.S. policy in Syria and other things, for sure, as well as just deep anti-Americanism. But also, you know, it's the government's choice to elevate these issues and to ensure that on the front page of Yeni Shafak or Sabah every day is a story about this stuff. So they're pushing it. And again, they're pushing it because it's one of the things that unite their conservative religious constituency with the nationalist and nativist constituency. On other questions, I mean, just in terms of the language people use, in terms of talking about the Kurds or talking about the coup, the words, the phrases, the assumptions that underpin people's views are totally set by the government-associated media. And then, you know, regarding the Afrin operation, there's just no independent reporting, or Euphrates Shield before that, or the Kurdish conflict before that. There's really no access to independent information for most of the Turkish public. So Erdogan's kind of nationalist, you know, the national alliance narrative that he's been able to craft with Bahçeli is pretty effective. The other thing is just some longer term trends where years of AKP rhetoric and Turkish government and government affiliated media, press and policy have had an effect. So on this question of, is Turkey a leader for the Muslim world, where now strong majorities across all political parties agree that Turkey should be a strong leader in the Muslim world, that's a change. That's actually a remarkable change, considering where the CHP would have been if you'd asked that question a decade ago or 15 years ago. So yeah, unquestionably, the control of information and the news media, the context in which politics are being conducted in Turkey is absolutely essential to these results. And, you know, not something that's likely to change in the near or midterm.
What about the question of the Kurds? Because in a way, we're talking here based on this assumption that, you know, opinion can shift politics. But over the last couple of years, we've seen really the complete decimation of the HDP, the pro-Kurdish party. Almost all local administrations run by it in the southeast have been replaced by state-appointed trustees. Its MPs and its leaders have been jailed, or many of them. And there's now a sense that however people vote in the next election, it won't really matter because the kind of managing of the political system in Turkey is so complete and so severe now. And of course, you know, into this situation, we now see this new election law, which was passed this week, and it contains some very worrying things, really, about state-appointed polling station heads, you know, the moving and merging of ballot boxes, putting police in polling stations, while also kind of legalizing this idea of forming election alliances between parties. And you do think, you know, when one thinks about how all these things are going to be applied across Kurdish majority areas, it really, it does kind of give one pause to wonder really about how they're going to affect the popular will or the expression of the popular will.
It's extremely troubling. The new elections law has a number of provisions that, in my view, make it very likely that there will be, you know, direct fraud, and let alone the sort of indirect fraud of moving voting places to make it very difficult for example, Kurdish voters to vote. Now, remember, you know, we had the November election in the context of real chaos. Of course, the April referendum in context of fighting and hundreds of thousands of displaced people in the southeast. So, and the HDP still managed to clear the thresholds. So the HDP in our poll is at 9%. That's still within cracking distance of the threshold. But so I think in a free election, the HDP likely, you know, has a pretty good shot at getting there. But again, you don't necessarily need nationwide ballot box stuffing with now they can use unstamped ballots. Now, as you say, the parties will no longer have representatives overseeing the ballot boxes. It will be state appointed, you know, a whole series of things that will make it very easy to cheat, unfortunately. So you wouldn't necessarily need massive fraud. You just need targeted fraud. And unfortunately, in the southeast, that's likely to happen. I you know, the political imperatives are such for Erdogan and the AKP, and frankly, the rhetoric has so vilified the HDP as basically a PKK affiliate that even if it's not a top-down process, surely a number of security personnel and local ballot box officials will take extraordinary steps of their own accord, you know, viewing this as a struggle against terror. And then the fundamental question, of course, now with the HDP leadership in jail and you know, of course, the municipal governments removed, is where is the political path for Kurds? You know, this is the fundamental question alongside the Syrian refugee issue. The fundamental question of Turkey's long-term stability is the Kurdish question. And the government policy has unfortunately removed the pathways by which Kurdish political sentiment can be, you know, can be expressed in parliament by arresting and ejecting Kurdish parliamentarians. So it's really disconcerting. And clearly in the southeast, people are scared. You don't have to talk to many people to know that the idea of protesting publicly is you're taking your life into your own hands to do so. And people they're scared, and they're not going to challenge an authoritarian structure that's backed up by force with no prospect of kind of democratic redress. So it's really troubling. And for all the kind of poll breakdowns and political analysis that we did, you know, building off of this research, that is important in terms of understanding what's going on, you still can't escape that nagging feeling that it might not matter in the end if this new elections law is implemented in the way that we all fear.
Looking forward, we mentioned there the AKP and the MHP's so-called National Alliance. And one of the things that comes through really in the report is that the two parties do share a very similar base in terms of, you know, socio-economic profile. And it seems to me really for that reason that they're almost pushing an open door there. Because of this similarity, it's much easier for the AKP and the MHP to come together. It's much easier to do, for example, than for the AKP and the HDP during the peace process. So because there's this natural shared set of assumptions, it does seem that this AKP-MHP alliance is likely to be much more resilient going forward.
Unquestionably, the AKP and the MHP constituencies have huge overlap. I mean, they have very similar views on secularism and religion, for example, which is sort of interesting in light of the party's histories. They have very similar views on questions of nationalism and sort of standing up to global elites, standing up to the West. There is, again, pushing on an open door on all of these questions. The thing that divides the MHP, though, is Erdogan. Despite Erdogan's efforts to, and Bahçeli's efforts to sort of fuse the parties into this alliance, 60 65% of MHP voters disapprove of Erdogan. And that's basically unchanged from a year ago. You know, that's two-thirds of MHP voters basically don't like Erdogan. And that's what's divided the MHP. That's, of course, what led Meral Akşener to challenge Bahçeli in the first place. So that 65% who approves Erdogan is almost identical to the 68% of MHP voters who wanted Akşener to run the party back when there was this leadership contest with Bahçeli. So it's going to be really interesting to see. I think that's part of what's driven Bahçeli to form this election, this formal alliance with the AKP, because he expects to fall below the threshold. And that's because probably 60, 65% of the party might abandon him. And where they go, the assumption being that they'll go to EE party, but that's just an assumption. Where they go will matter a great deal if this election is conducted fairly.
That was Max Hoffman. Many thanks to him. There's a link to the report and further analysis of the polling results up at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. This was Max's second appearance on the podcast after we spoke about a previous study he was involved in on civil society in Turkey. That episode was published last August, so feel free to Google it or click on the link that I've put up at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Remember to consider joining the Turkey Book Talk membership system. The deal is not bad value at all. If you pledge a minimum $3 per episode, you'll get access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every episode as it's published, as well as the entire Turkey Book Talk archive and exclusive access to a special 30% discount on a selection of over 200 books on Turkey and Ottoman history published by IB Taurus. You'll be helping Turkey Book Talk to keep the show on the road, developing further and providing a bigger platform for our guests and their work. So find links with information on how to sign up on all the Turkey Book Talk websites. Also spare a minute to rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever podcast platform you listen on. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes, and you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.